This week on Pirate Party Radio, the MPAA and RIAA want to install anti-infringement software on your computer. The U.S. governments may be faking SSL certificates, and the Pirate Party helps the elderly defeat Australian censorship. This is Pirate Party Radio, episode 24 for Thursday, April 15th, 2010.
If we look at the text, we see that notwithstanding the best efforts and now 8 rounds of negotiation, there is still a lot of disagreement. Notwithstanding the efforts to keep all of this secret, there is a leak almost a week, it would seem, with respect to ACTA. And so notwithstanding efforts to say we're going to get this done within a matter of months and we're going to keep the public completely out of the process, we now have meetings where 100 people will show up on a Saturday with the actual text sitting on the table. That tells us that this issue isn't done yet.
We are under siege. They are doing everything they can to prevent progress, to prevent the spread of culture, and to prevent privacy as we know it. The only way to stop this is to unite. This is definitely a global movement. It's continuing to spread across the world like wildfire. We are seeing the birth of a new global political power. There's no way to control the information. There's no way to control culture, to control knowledge. And those who control culture and knowledge control the world. And that is losing its last cause. People don't understand how big this really is.
I'm James O'Brien, and welcome to Pirate Party Radio, the official show of the Pirate Party of Canada and the U.S., your source for news around the world on copyright, net neutrality, open government, free culture and speech, patents, privacy, and more. Make sure you check out the Pirate Party Radio forums for all the links to the news story I mentioned during the show. And off the top of the show, we had an intro clip from Michael Geist, a Canadian. He's down in New Zealand, where he gave a talk on ACTA, and that was a short clip from a 45-minute talk that he gave on Sunday about the latest ACTA negotiations that are taking place right now from the April 12th to 16th in Wellington, New Zealand, and you can watch the whole 45-minute talk with the link off the Pirate Party Radio forums. We've got some incoming messages from some listeners. This one's from Mind Inversion. I'm sending the link below, not because it's newsworthy in of itself, but because it's a great example of the power and deceit in the media that has in its reporting. The article focusing on alleged anger over the way in which the digital economy bill is enacted is shoved into a non-picked link on the R8 right-hand side of the BBC website in the technology section. The title, Anger Over Stitch-Up, is moderately potentially misleading in of itself. Note, when you click on the link, the title extends to Anger About Stitch-Up Over Digital Economy Bill. From the technology section of the BBC Online, title only reads Anger Over Stitch-Up. Then we get to the article. At no time does the article mention that after 1 year, a 3-strikes law provision kicks off due to this legislation. It simply states that notices will be sent and someone may be wrongly accused for living in the same house. Of course, in true media style, they greatly play up the great need to protect artist and industry. At this point, nothing actually surprises me anymore, but sometimes I marvel how greatly this type of propaganda journalism still enrages me. So tell me, Sim, when does a revolution start? It's obvious that the governments of the world have fallen to the terrorism of the global corporate syndicate. Don't we all, as enlightened beings, have a patriotic duty to stand up and defend our various countries from tyranny and oppression? I like that, actually. Since the industry doesn't like the word pirate, maybe the party should be named the Patriot Party. Mind Inversion. And that's a perfect example why the Pirate Party is getting so much support around the world. And we'll get to some growings in the Pirate Party later on in the show. Another one from Death Inviticus. Just listening to your cast via unmetered radio stations provided by my internet service provider. Good of them, eh? Interesting to hear about the six principles being introduced in the states for net neutrality. Too bad I live in a country where our government thinks it has the right to control what we access via lists that are both inaccurate and hidden from public scrutiny, bit like we don't have an R rating for games as of yet either. You've obviously heard it all already, but I'm fairly certain the government isn't interested in my opinion. I'm obviously not an uninformed voter who can be easily scared of large heapings of bull. I do not feel like I'm represented by an elected official in this country in this regard. Yeah, I live in Australia, and sometimes I wonder why. And that was from Death in Viticus. Thank you for those letters. And if you'd like to send me a letter, a comment or a question, or just something you'd like to get off your chest, or something about one of these stories that I've talked about, just head over to Pirate Party Radio site at piratepartyradio.com and fill out the feedback form. Just submit, type it in there. You don't even have to use your real name and hit submit, and it'll go right to me. And I've got something that was posted on the Pirate Party UK website. It was about the 300th anniversary of copyright being introduced. And it's called Happy Birthday, Dear Copyright. Happy Birthday to you. 300 years ago today, copyright was born. Conceived in 1709, the Statue of Anne, as it's sometimes known, came into force on the 10th of April, 1710. Despite going by the nickname of Copyright Act 1709, it was born with a much grander appellation, an act for the encouragement of learning by vesting the copies of printed books in the authors or purchasers of such copies during the times therein mentioned. Taking another look at that impressive title, we can imagine how the parents intended for their product to develop. If they had been cursed with considerable foresight and saw how copyright grew up and developed, I believe that they would be as horrified as those of us who can see the copyright for the monster it's become. If we try and draw a parallel between the Statute of Anne and recent copyright legislation, including the Copyright Designs and Patents Act of 1988 and the Digital Economy Act of 2010, we can see a stark difference in their intent. Anne speaks about the encouragement of learning, breaking the monopoly held by publishers, and a 14-plus-14-year protection limitation, and fines for infringement were to be split between the Crown and the author. The very central tenet of Anne was to create a mutually beneficial system between creators and the public that would encourage creativity by giving short-term protection to commercial exploitation, while ensuring that the very creations themselves would become free public property of society, public domain. Contrast this with the language of more recent legislation. In the CDPA 1988, protection terms are extended in some cases to 70 years after the death of an author. Anyone finding me a dead author who is encouraged to further creativity by this length in a term wins a prize. When we come to the educational provisions, remember Anne was an act for the encouragement of learning. The CDPA 1988 makes the following provision: reprographic copying is only permitted within a limit of 1% of the work per 3-month period. Works may be performed in educational establishments without infringing copyright, provided that no members of the public are present. The parents of pupils are considered members of the public. So who does get excused from respecting these new copyright laws? The CDPA 1988 states that copyright is not infringed by anything done for the purposes of parliamentary or judicial proceedings, should we be surprised. Those that have been accused en masse of dishonesty and even theft have unfettered parliamentary rights to ignore copyright, and at the same time they point their fingers and accuse others of stealing. With the technology turning the world on its head, it is important to understand copyright in the digital age. But when we look at the 2010 Digital Economy Act, not a bill because it's been passed, what we see is gross misunderstanding from Parliament of the technology and, two, the original purpose of copyright acts. Instead of the following, Anne is breaking the destructive monopoly of the publishers, vast swaths of the DE Act of 2010 were in fact written by those very entities. So here we are looking at disastrous new legislation. So how can we pay homage and respect to the original intentions of copyright on the 300th birthday? Instinctively, we might wish to gather and sing happy birthday. But even that simple act is now fraught with difficulties and copyright implications. Were we to try to do this publicly, we'd either have to need a license to do so, or we'd be risk breaking the law. A very interesting commentary from PirateParty.uk. Pirate Party UK commenting about the recent passing of the Digital Economy Act and the 300th anniversary of the copyright, quite coincidental in its passing time. In pirate news, free speech from Australia. I thought I'd start the show off with some positive news, something that's being helped by the Pirate Party in Australia. Pirate Party and Philip Nitschke teach seniors to hack Filter, sent in by DC. Pro-euthanasia group Exit International is holding national hacking crash courses in how to bypass the federal government's planned ISP-level internet content filter with help from the Australian Pirate Party. The first of 8 hacking masterclasses was held in Chatswood, NSW, on Thursday last week and drew about 50 elderly people, some bearing laptops. Exit International director and controversial Australian physician Philip Nitschke created the class to help the elderly access euthanasia assistant material online, following fears that the internet filter will block access to the information. A leaked copy of the filter blacklist revealed Exit International websites, the UK publisher of Peaceful Pill e-handbook, and 3 YouTube videos were on the list of banned materials. We were comprehensively listed, Nitschke told Computer World. We weren't totally surprised, but it will drastically curtail our ability to get information to our 5,000 Australian members. The Peaceful Pill handbook was published free online after the hard copy version was banned in Australia, following the revocation of the original R18 Plus classification by then federal attorney Philip Ruddock in 2006. Nitschke turned to the Australian Pirate Party via the Electronic Frontiers Australia to locate an IT expert capable of teaching an average 70-year-old how to access pro-euthanasia material by using a proxy server to bypass the proposed national internet firewall. They found David Campbell from Newcastle-based company Clear Computers and a member of the Australian Pirate Party. They approached the Pirate Party of Australia and asked them if they could recommend any hackers that could help them out, to which I put my hand up, Campbell said. I broke it down as simply as I could, starting with a very basic explanation of how the internet works and how it delivers websites, among other services, to computers. Then we gave them a basic explanation of exactly how the government plans on filtering the internet, like putting a lollipop person on a zebra crossing, and then everyone could just jaywalk around them anyway. About 100 people have signed on to the Perth hacking class to be held 7th of April. Each workshop takes about 5.5 hours and will also be held in Melbourne, Hobart, Adelaide, Brisbane, Canberra, and Sydney. A spokeswoman for the Communications Minister, Stephen Conroy, said it is not illegal to teach or enact methods to bypass a proposed internet filter, following reports that the classes could be outlawed. Under the government's policy, it will not be an offence to circumvent the filtering measures or to show someone how to do so, the spokeswoman said. She said the Peaceful Pill e-handbook is refused classification and its website will be blocked. So that is very interesting information straight from the government itself. It is not illegal to bypass Australians' web blocking software that is planned to be put in place. So that's a perfect opportunity for the Australian Pirate Party to post information on how to easily bypass the internet filters. So if elderly people can do it, so can you, to get around the filters of Australia. It is completely ineffective in China and places around the world like that where blocks are in place. It's going to be ineffective in Australia. The internet routes around censorship. There is always a way to get it through. In worldwide copyright news, file sharers safe until Music Biz changes laws, sent in by DC. And this is about the new tactics of the media corporations and how they're going to start going after copyright infringement on the internet. After failing in their case against the Pirate Bay, a music copyrights group has announced that it will give up trying to get sites blocked and will leave file sharers alone. Not forever, though. They will instead put all their efforts into getting the law changed. The IFPI said yesterday that it wants to bring the same strategy to your country soon. The last decade has thrown up a number of complex David and Goliath-style copyright battles between large corporations and various file-sharing sites, services, and individuals. Largely, the effort has been to convince the courts that the current laws are applicable to the cases in question, from the shutting down of Napster in 2001 through to the most recent criminal case in Sweden involving the Pirate Bay. The utilization of existing law brings quicker results, but only in the short term and at significant expense. New laws created and based on the desires of the music industry are a much better solution for them in the longer term, providing faster routes to site closures and more cost-effective solutions to deal with individuals. With this in mind, lobbying by the music and movie industries have continued apace, even in countries where existing law still yields results. For example, in the UK, existing copyright law was used effectively against Usenet indexer Newsbin recently, and it is used regularly to reveal the identities of tens of thousands of alleged file sharers, so they can be pursued for settlements. But why spend millions suing sites or individuals out of existence, along with all the bad publicity that brings, when one can get the government to block them at a hugely reduced cost? One only has to look to the UK's Digital Economy Bill for a clear example where lobbying has been used to massively cut the cost and possibly even the need for future litigation. Don't like a site like Newsbin in the future? Forget costly injunctions. Write a couple of letters to the right people and it'll be blocked. Don't like the Pirate Bay or RapidShare? Same applies. Sometimes, however, the current law simply isn't up to the requirements of the mainstream entertainment industry and yields zero results. The IFPI and music right outfits Tono discovered this recently after their second attempt at forcing ISP Telenor to block the Pirate Bay ended in failure. They could have taken the case on the Supreme Court, but clearly they know the law isn't on their side, and they've announced they've given up on current legal action. We have no plans to try more file-sharing cases in court before we're confident that we have a basis in Norwegian law, the Tono Cato Power said this week. Tono hasn't given up on lobbying, though. If the law is no good, they say, it's time to get it changed, and that could be soon. Norway's Ministry of Culture is gathering together a group including the Norwegian Publishers Association, the Consumer Council, Gramo Music Rights Group, and ISP's Telenor and Next Gen Tel. Their job will be to provide solutions to restrict illicit file sharing and encourage an increased use of legal services by June 1, 2010. Of course, Tono will take the opportunity to champion a three-strike-style solution similar to present in the heavily lobbied-for Hadopi law currently lying in wait in France or the newly passed Digital Economy Bill in the UK. Furthermore, all the signs that are that in the coming years, the music industry will maintain its aggressive lobbying until it gets this type of mechanism implemented in all its major markets. So there's the new scheme for the copyright enforcement teams out there going against your ability to get to the websites that you want on the internet, regardless if they think it's either an illegal act or a morally illegal act. That's their new tactics. Copyright news from the UK, following up some more stories because of the recent passage of the bill into Act. UK government approves three strikes website filtering and bans public Wi-Fi. Now, I included this story because it kind of breaks down how this new bill, Digital Economy Act, is going to affect people living in the UK. Sent in by DC. Digital Economy Bill sails through the House of Commons after a mere 2 hours of debate, moves to the House of Lords where it's expected to rubber stamp the legislation and soon will get royal assent, which it already did. It did get royal assent on the 12th, so this has already passed. Yesterday, the UK's House of Commons passed a controversial Digital Economy Bill. Blah, 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 blah. I'm going to skip down the page a little bit to how it's going to impact. So what does it mean for you? After apparent copyright abuse, copyright holders can send a copyright infringement report to ISPs with evidence of the downloading within 1 month of the alleged incident. The ISP must notify its subscriber within a month, providing evidence and information about appeals and legal advice. So what they're going to do is get on a peer-to-peer file sharing program, start a torrent of a piece of media that they hold the copyrights for, either a movie or music, get the IPs, trace it back to the ISPs, send that in along with the name of the media that they found that somebody was downloading. They don't know who this is, but they're just going to send it in. And then ISPs, if requested, must provide copyright holders with a copyright infringement list, listing each infringement by an individual anonymized user. Now, that's very interesting. So the copyright holders can ask the ISP for a list of people that infringed on a copyright, but it's anonymized list. Now, I don't know how that exactly works. I guess these are already things that the media corporations have already sent into the ISPs saying, we have found this person, we have found this person, we have found this person. The ISP has to maintain a list and then, at their request, send it back whenever they want a huge list of IP addresses. I guess this is in preparation for court cases or just to send threatening letters to. Goes on. Number three, the government can tell Ofcom, and Ofcom is the equivalent of the a branch of kind of the FCC in the United States, can tell Ofcom whether it should order ISPs to sanction speed blocks, bandwidth shaping, site blocking, account suspension, or other limits against an ISP customer. First, Ofcom must do consultation and consider whether these measures would work. So they can just shut down a website completely, block it from all of Britain because of one of the pieces of information on that website is allegedly infringing on copyright. A little bit dangerous there because everything is copyrighted. Even what I'm saying is automatically copyrighted in Canada. Everything you write down, everything you say is copyrighted. The whole internet, in essence, is copyrighted by somebody else unless you put it up. Anybody can go after anybody. So these are a little bit far-reaching. If the measures pass Ofcom's muster, the government could then level the measures against ISPs, but only approved by both houses of parliament. I'm sure the media corporations are going to get these streamlined. Subscribers can appeal to an independent person named in Ofcom's code, and then later to a first-tier tribunal. Costs would be met by the ISP, copyright holder, and subscriber. Number six. ISPs that fail to apply technical measures against subscribers can be fined up to $250,000, as Ofcom determines. So, it's now on the ISPs to do the work to shut down subscribers that are copyright infringement, alleged copyright infringers. So they're going to be fined if they don't do the work for the media corporations. They're going to be fined £250,000. Copyright owners, seven, copyright owners must pay Ofcom's costs. Both copyright owners and ISPs must pay costs of implementing technical measures. Accused subscribers must also share appeal costs. So all the costs are going to be going to the subscribers and the ISPs. So that's great for the copyright owners. A lot of money is going to be put on the onus of the ISPs. They're not a common carrier. They have some onus now of what is going through their internet. They have to be the police of the internet now to make sure that nobody's infringing on copyright. This is going to be a huge burden on ISPs in terms of monetary, and they're going to have to pass these costs on to the consumer. Now, that's the only way I can see this happening, is if all these costs are going to be coming down the pipeline, and these measures, this act was put into place so that these things would happen, so that they would be going after subscribers. So this is going to happen. These costs are coming to the ISPs in Britain, so expect your rates to go sky high as the accusations come in. They're just going to troll the whole internet for any infringement, and it's going to be flooding, the paperwork's going to be flooding in the offices of the ISPs in Britain. And finally, number eight, High Court can grant injunction forcing ISPs to block access to online locations if a substantial portion of that location infringes copyright. ISPs must pay copyright owners court fees unless in exceptional circumstances. However, courts will have to consider the effect on legitimate users, uses, and users of sites before granting blocking injunctions, and ISPs will not be expected to pay court costs to ensure that there is no incentive on ISPs to block a site until or unless they have a court order requiring them to do so. So that kind of implies that ISPs are going to maybe proactively start blocking websites that they think they're going to get paper served them for. So maybe they're going to go and shut down, you know, Pirate Bay first, or maybe extend it even to YouTube, because they're going to be start going after people who are posting stuff on YouTube that is copyright infringed upon the works of the owners. And they can get those sites blocked from the ISP's side. And if the ISPs don't comply, then they're going to get fined. And then it goes on. It gets even more frightening. Also, as probably the worst part, is that it bans public access Wi-Fi so that libraries, universities, local pubs, cafes, churches, community halls, etc. don't become loopholes for copyright infringement in the three strikes age as proposed by the Digital Economy Bill. Now, what they're talking about there is that those places, libraries, universities, pubs, cafes, are going to be turning into, you know, quote, ISPs, because they're providing access, and the onus would go on to them. They'd be starting to be fined $250,000. Now, would you, as an owner of a coffee shop on the corner of the street, be willing to go to court for the people that come in and buy coffee for $2 or a dollar or $5 and be willing to be taken to court for £250,000, most won't. They're going to be shut. You're going to see a lot of free Wi-Fi access. The coffee shops be shut down. And this is a service that a lot of these places, especially the libraries and universities, are giving to people for free, so that people that don't have maybe the resources or money to pay for access to the internet are going to lose this access and are not going to be able to have the access to information they once had. Kind of frightening. So it's worth a read to see how this is going to affect you in Britain if you live in the UK, and how it's going to affect you directly, because it's going to. People are going to be getting extremely paranoid about what they do on the internet. Even those websites where they have a whole bunch of funny pictures on the websites. You know, those collections of funny pictures with captions of things. People took those pictures. They are essentially copyrighted. And this opens up a whole world of hurt for anything on the internet that is not pretty much you're getting it from the official original person who made it. Like, everybody would be sort of sequestered to the original websites. If you wanted to get any kind of media, you wouldn't be able to get any kind of information except from the media corporation. It's going to be turned into a walled garden where everybody is herded into, you know, three or four major websites. And the internet's going to become a very boring place very soon in Britain. Net neutrality news from the US. Verizon CEO: we will find pirates, throttle them, and charge extra. This is sent by DC. CEO Ivan Seinberg said it has to be able to deal with the 5% or 10% of customers that are abusers, chewing up all the bandwidth, and that net neutrality interferes with its ability to do so. Verizon CEO Ivan Seinberg gave us an interesting interview at the Council for Foreign Relations a few days ago that proves the urgent need for Congress to enact net neutrality legislation, especially being that on the same day ISP Comcast won its appeal of an earlier FCC ruling that sanctioned it for throttling BitTorrent connections as part of an overall network management program. Anytime government, whether it's the FCC or agency, decides it knows what the market wants and makes that a static requirement, you always lose, he said. So this FCC decided that the speed of the network was the most important issue, so that's all they measured. Oh really, the FCC doesn't care about speed per se, but rather maintaining its open and accessible internet for all, thereby fulfilling President Obama's campaign promise to also protect the openness of the internet. As a candidate, then-Senator Obama also said that throttling of BitTorrent and other P2P applications would be illegal. All the FCC ever wanted is for Comcast to quit singling out BitTorrent in order to manage network traffic, not to maintain some arbitrary network speed. Seidenberg also insists that the U.S. has the best broadband system in the world, in part because of its greater household penetration, that it's important to, that the markets be allowed to decide what's important to the customers. In Japan, where everyone looks at Japan as being so far ahead, they may have faster speeds, but we have higher utilization of people using the internet. He says, so our view is, whenever you look at these issues, you have to be very careful to look at what the market wants, not what the government says is the most important issue. But the problem was with that is the customers aren't always allowed to decide what they want. As they say, vote with your feet. Oftentimes, ISPs have carved out their territories that make it the only game in town, preventing the sort of choice that Seidenberg says should prevail over government intervention. Without government intervention, ISPs will be allowed to dictate selection, pricing, and accessibility. With Comcast's purchase of NBC Universal last December, we're seeing broadband providers merge with content providers and the transition to digital media distribution. What happens when ISPs decide to throttle competing application and services or block them altogether? So what I see here is kind of a muddling. Every time somebody brings up net neutrality, the ISPs trot out that it interferes with their ability to be able to manage their networks properly. They say, well, we've got to be able to cut off this and scale down this so it doesn't overwhelm our service. Well, there are measures to deal with that. One is to not say that you're unlimited bandwidth. Because if you're limiting people and saying, get off our internet, because you're using up too much, then you start charging for the people that are using too much. Set it out in the beginning. Say you have 100 gigs for the month, and if you go over the 100 gigs, you have to pay more. People know how much more they have to pay, and they can regulate themselves. Don't say you have unlimited internet, and then say you have to get off our network because you're using too much. And also, the ISP should have no say in what people use on their internet, unless it's impacting their internet completely. And if their routers or equipment cannot keep up with the latest technology, including BitTorrent, they need to update what they can do in their ISPs, what they can handle in their head ends. They should be able to handle YouTube, streaming video, BitTorrent, all these new applications that are being used day to day. And you can implement bandwidth priorities in terms of what is applications that need real-time information. The BitTorrents are not the most top priority things that are needed on the internet. Voice over IP, real-time applications such as real-time video conferencing and voice communications, those are the things that get highest priorities. And you can scale it down from there. You don't need to scale back the BitTorrents to a certain level. You just need to place priorities over things. So somebody's BitTorrent doesn't overtake a voice over IP communication. And that is easily obtainable with the equipment they have or equipment they can get. They always muddle in net neutrality with being able to prioritize the different protocols on the internet, and it's ridiculous. And all they are doing is fighting so that they can control their networks in terms of what is accessible and what is not, because they're such conglomerates that the huge ISPs in the US are not just ISPs, they own the content that is going through their pipes. They own the content, and they want to be able to dictate who gets the faster content. So if you go to two websites, one is owned by one content provider, one is owned by another content provider, and the first piece of media is also a subsidiary of the ISP, you know which one they're going to give priority to. And that's what net neutrality is about, putting everybody on an even scale so they can't arbitrarily slow somebody else down. And it always makes me upset that they try and muddle net neutrality in with things that are completely unrelated, and they confuse people that don't really know how the internet works. Privacy news from the U.S. The entertainment industry's dystopia of the future, sent in by Mind Inversion. This is from EFF.org. We're not easily shocked by entertainment industry overreaching. Unfortunately, it's par for the course. But we were taken aback by the wish list the industry submitted in response to the Intellectual Property Enforcement Coordinator's request for comments on the forthcoming Joint Strategic Plan for Intellectual Property Enforcement. The comments submitted by various organizations provide a kind of window into how these organizations both view intellectual property and the public interest. For example, EFF and other public interest groups have asked the IPAC to take a balanced approach to intellectual property enforcement, paying close attention to the actual harm caused, the potential unexpected consequences of government intervention, and compelling countervailing priorities. The joint comment filed by the Motion Picture Association of America and the Recording Industry Association of America and others stand as sharp contrast, mapping out a vision of the future where big media priorities are woven deep into the internet, law enforcement, and educational institutions. Now it gets really scary. Wait for this. Consider the following, all taken from the entertainment industry submission to the IPAC. Anti-infringement software for home computers. There are several technologies and methods that can be used by network administrations and providers. These include consumer tools for managing copyright infringements from the home, based on tools used to protect consumers from viruses and malware. In other words, the entertainment industry thinks consumers should voluntarily install software that constantly scans our computers and identifies, and perhaps deletes, files found to be infringing. It's hard to believe that the industry thinks savvy, security-conscious consumers would voluntarily do so. But those who remember the Sony BMG rootkit debacle knows that the entertainment industry is all too willing to sacrifice consumers at the altar of copyright enforcement. It sounds like they want to package in together a scanning piece of software in with your viruses and malware as if it's something that's damaging to your computer, to your ears. A very interesting way they group that in. Pervasive copyright filtering. This is the second one. Network administrators and providers should be encouraged to implement those solutions that are available and reasonable to address infringement on their network. The suggestion is preceded by a list of filtering methods like protocol filtering, fingerprint-based filtering, and bandwidth throttling, etc. The entertainment industry loves widespread filtering as a solution to online copyright infringement. In fact, it has successfully persuaded Congress to push these technologies on institutions of higher education. But this solution is full of flaws. First, even the best automated copyright blocking systems fail to protect fair use, which is true. You get 2 seconds of a snippet of a song, and it's going to shut down, say, an hour-long program, hour-long video, and is going to delete it off your hard drive if it's found to fingerprint match a portion of Happy Birthday. It's going to delete that file from your system. And that could be considered fair use depending on the application that it's being used in. At worst, these techniques are unlikely to make any lasting dent on infringement behavior, but will instead just invite the use of more encryption and private darknets, or even just more hand-to-hand sharing of hard drives and burned DVDs. But perhaps the most pernicious effect may be that copyright protection measures can be Trojan horses for consumer surveillance. In the age of warrantless wiretapping and national censorship, building more surveillance and inspection technologies into the heart of the internet is obviously a bad idea. In the words of a Hollywood movie, if they you build it, they will come. And the third one, intimidate and propagandize travelers at the border. Customs authorities should be encouraged to do more to educate the traveling public and entrants into the United States about these issues. In particular, points of entry into the United States are underused venues for educating the public about the threat of our economy and to public safety posed by counterfeit and pirate products. Customs forms should be amended to require the disclosure of pirate or counterfeited items being brought into the United States. That's a weird one. Yeah, put a checkbox on the piece of paper. Are you bringing counterfeited goods into the country? Does that iPod in your hand luggage contain copies of songs extracted from your friend's CDs? Is your computer storing movies ripped from DVD, handy for conserving battery life on long trips? Was that book you bought overseas licensed for use in the United States? These are the kind of questions the industry would like you to answer on your customs form when you cross borders or return home from abroad. What is more, the suggestion also raises the specter of something we've heard in entertainment industry suggestions before. More searches and seizures of electronic goods at the border. Once border officials are empowered to search every electronic device for pirated content, digital privacy will all but disappear, at least for international travelers. From what we've learned about the fight over de minimis border measures, search exclusion in the latest leaked text, ACTA might just try to make this a reality. And it goes on and on about this. It's very interesting read, as per usual, from the EFF about what the entertainment industry's wish list is like. This is their dream list that they can bully the ISPs, the border guards, even you, directly you, to install things to defeat copyright infringement and to, trod on your freedoms, really, to do what you want with your own media. What if you're, time shifting something you taped off of television? That's going to go right out the window because it doesn't fingerprint match something that is allowed. It's going to be a file on your portable device that's going to match something that they have on their list, and you're going to get that seized at the border. Your laptop's going to be taken away, and it's going to be locked in, some warehouse for 2 years until it's obsolete, and then they'll give it back to you, if they give it back to you. Some very scary stuff, and that's what we've got to fight against. Copyright news from Nigeria. If piracy is killing filmmaking, why do Nigeria, China, and India have thriving movie businesses sent in by DC? We keep hearing from Hollywood folks that piracy is killing the movie business, yet there seems to be little evidence of that. The number of films being made each year continues to grow, and the box office keeps setting attendance and revenue records. But what if unauthorized copies were even more rampant? Kevin Kelly noticed that three countries that are normally considered hotbeds of unauthorized copies all seem to house the largest movie industries. The three largest film industries in the world are India, Nigeria, and China. Nigeria cranks out some 2,000 films a year. India produces about 1,000 a year, and China less than 500. Together, they produce four times as many films per year as Hollywood. Yet each of these countries is a haven, even a synonym for rampant piracy. How do post-copyright economics work? How do you keep producing more movies than Hollywood with no copyright protection for your efforts? This question was pertinent because the rampant piracy in the movie cultures of India, China, and Nigeria seemed to signal a future for Hollywood. Here in the West, we seem to be headed to YouTube land, where all the movies are free. In other words, we're speeding towards the copyright-free zones represented by China, India, and Nigeria today. If so, do those movie industries operate smack in the middle of the cheap, ubiquitous copies flooding these countries have any lessons to teach Hollywood on how to survive? Not everything he finds would be considered a good thing, since part of the answers involve likely underground markets and organized crime laundering money. That shouldn't take away from some of the key points. In all three countries, he found that, of course, the pirated versions, usually sold as video CDs, really acted as promotion for going to see the film in a theater, one of the few places in those countries where air conditioning is available. Some might point out that this isn't an issue in the US anymore. But if you take a step back, there's a larger point. If you provide a valuable experience, people will go. In Nigeria and India, it may be air conditioning, but in the US, it could be a lot of other things. High quality food, comfortable seating, better sound, etc. Second, he found that the industries in all three countries made money by licensing their movies to TV stations, who were desperate for content, suggesting that there are almost always other channels where a revenue can be obtained. Another point he found was that the movie makers recognize they need to compete with unauthorized copies and price things accordingly so that the price wasn't all that different than unauthorized VCDs. Now that did mean that some of the movies produced in these countries were quite low budget. But again, if you combine a higher quality movie with a real reason to buy, seeing in the theater, additional benefits for buying, there's no reason why big Hollywood movies can't take advantage of the same economics. Of course, some will also point out that when the unauthorized copies are downloaded rather than available on VCD, the cost of the competition goes to zero. Which is true, but none of that precludes offering additional scarce value for the buyers. In these countries, it may be just air conditioning. but there are plenty of other scarcities that can be sold in the U.S. as well. So interesting article about how to compete with free and examples given in the other countries. Now, it has happened a little bit here in North America where they're showing 3D movies, which are packing movie theaters. I mean, $3 billion from Avatar can't be wrong. It was shown in 3D and people went crazy for it. That may be just new hype and new car smell kind of thing happening there. But if you bring them to the theaters and they like the 3D, they will keep coming back for it and offering things like they're talking about, like comfortable seating and maybe more enforcement for troublemakers in the theaters that are texting while you're trying to watch a movie or talking on the cell phone or making noise or just being trouble and making it more enjoyable to go to the theater. And I know they kind of revolutionized theaters when they gave it the kind of stadium seating about 10 years ago, and everybody came back to the theater because it was a better way of seeing the movies. Now, privacy news from the U.S. Privacy groups want feds to investigate targeted ads sent in by Mindinversion. A trio of privacy groups want federal regulators to take a close look at ad networks that track web servers and sell targeted ads. The groups want the Federal Trade Commission to open an inquiry into whether these networks, including Google and Yahoo, are unfairly tracking Americans and profiting from their data. The World Privacy Forum and Center for Digital Democracy and USPIRG, public interest research groups, argue that online marketers are secretly combining online data with offline data and using that to run real-time ad auctions. Consumers will be most shocked to learn that the companies are instantaneously combining the details of their online lives with the information from previously unconnected offline databases without their knowledge, let alone their consent, said USPIRG Consumer Program Director Ed Mirzwinski. In just the last few years, a growing and barely regulated network of sellers and marketers have gained massive information advantages over consumers. Companies named in the complaint include Google, Yahoo, PubMatic, Targus Info, MediaMath, Accelate, Rubicon Project, AppNexus, and Rocket Fuel. And at issue is a growing market of targeted real-time ads where advertisers can choose to show ads to people based on their age, gender, income, and location, as well as the recent online behavior, often on unrelated sites that let third parties track users. For instance, Wired.com uses DoubleClick to serve ads, and it tracks users across the web using cookies. Third-party cookie tracking isn't new, but as the complaint points out, marketers are increasingly trying to augment that data with other datasets, such as the social network data that Rapleaf harvests and resells. Google has long held that its model of displaying ads based on the content of a webpage and search term trumped the advantages of user tracking, but entered that market as well after it purchased the display ad giant DoubleClick. However, the company says its advertising cookies and tracking are separate from the user's account cookies, so its advertising database does not know your real name or Google login credentials. Tying ad cookies to personally identifiable data would let marketers successfully combine online and offline data on website visitors to build a complete digital dossier on a user. The groups want the FTC to investigate whether the companies are violating fair business laws. They also demand that the companies get users' permission to sell them at auction, pay them for their use of data, and update their privacy policies to let users know that personally identifiable information is being used to send them ads. Well, the last part is interesting and relevant, but it's not going to make a lot of difference, I don't think, because you can ask for people's permission. They're just going to click yes whenever they see it on the screen. And also, they're going to, if they change their privacy policies to let the users know, these things are hundreds of pages long sometimes, and people aren't going to read through every line. It's going to be buried three quarters through on some page. People aren't going to know what kind of privacy policies there are unless they listen to shows like this or read about them when after the fact, when they've hit the mainstream news and it's way too late, where their information is collected in massive databases. Now, the other side of this is this data is just being used to serve ads. The danger, really, is if somebody can get a hold of this data. Whether the data is going to fall into the hands of somebody who's going to use it for targeted purposes, whether to prey on vulnerable people or trying to bilk money off of them somehow. Because when you've got databases this big, full of tens of millions, even hundreds of millions of users, they're not going to care about the individual. It's all going to be matched with computers. It's about the danger of this data getting out and in the hands. It's the security of the data that is, I feel, the really important part about it. In privacy news from the US, new research suggests that governments may fake SSL certificates sent in by Weird Wolf. I can't believe I missed this one, but it should have been in last week. Weird Wolf says, I first saw the story on Pirate Party US website. Basically, they're saying that there's some evidence that the US government is working with the SSL, TLS, HTTPS to be able to sniff the associated encrypted traffic that they may need to get access to. And this is from the EFF.org website. Today, two computer security researchers, Christopher and Sid, released a draft of the forthcoming research paper in which they presented evidence that the certificate authorities may be cooperating with government agencies to help them spy undetected on secure encrypted communications. More details and reporting are available at Wired. The draft paper includes marketing materials from Packet Forensics, an Arizona company, which suggests that the government users have the ability to import a copy of any legitimate keys they obtain potentially by court order into Packet Forensics products in order to impersonate sites and trick users into a false sense of security afforded by web, email, or VoIP encryption. This would allow the government to routinely bypass encryption without breaking it. Many modern encryption systems, including SSL TLS system, used for encrypted HTTPS web browsing, rely on a public key infrastructure, in which a number of the CAs are trusted to vouch for the identity of sites and services. The CA role is crucial for detecting and preventing man-in-the-middle attacks, where outsiders invisibly impersonate one of the parties to communicate in order to spy on encrypted messages. CAs make a lot of money, and their only job is to make accurate statements about which cryptographic keys are authentic. If they do this job incorrectly, willingly, under compulsion, by accident, or negligently, the security of the encrypted communications falls apart as man-in-the-middle attacks go undetected. These attacks are not technically difficult. Surveillance companies like Packet Forensics sell tools to automate the process, while security researchers like Moxie Marlinspike have publicly released tools to do the same. All that's needed to make the attack seamless is a false certificate. Can one be obtained? So this is extremely frightening news that it's possible that you can't trust the SSL certificates anymore. That something is going on behind the scenes. Now this is just alleged. Now this is things that are kind of pointing in that direction. So I would definitely suggest that you go on and read this information there. I've got two reports out of Mexico that are indicating a very large lockdown on data communications down there. The first one is sent in by Weird Wolf. Increased reports of kidnapping lead to calls for phone registry. Tens of millions of Mexicans could find their cell phones disconnected this weekend. They actually did go ahead and do that. If the government goes ahead with the new law meant to fight crime by forcing people to register their identities. Advertisements on government radio and television have been urging Mexicans for weeks to register their cell phone by sending their personal details as a text message. But on Thursday, 30 million lines remained unregistered as the Saturday deadline neared. So it was last Saturday that they cut off 30 million cell phones. Analysts said that that any related losses for Mexico's largest wire operator, America Movil, would be a tiny relative to the company's overall sales. Still, America Movil, controlled by billionaire Carlos Slim, is urging senators to extend the deadline for implementing the law passed a year ago to try and stop criminals from using cell phones for extortion and negotiate ransoms and kidnappings. Close to 30 million people will be affected, many of whom depend on mobile phones as their only means of communications. America Movil's head of institutional relations, Guillermo Ferre, said in email comments, most of Mexico's 84 million mobile phones are prepaid handsets with a limited number of minutes that can be easily bought in stores. The phones can be topped up with more minutes through street corner vendors. America Movil has 71% of Mexico's wireless market, along with operations in Brazil, Chile, and other countries in the region. Most of the rest of Mexico's cell phone market is in the hands of Spain's Telefónica. Well, the problem I see with this is that it doesn't matter whether the phones get registered in Mexico, if the people in Mexico phone these phones and the other ones get cut off. It doesn't matter because people traveling to this, to Mexico from the US or other countries outside of it don't have to register their cell phones with the Mexican government. So all the people that are dealing with the kidnappings or the drug rings down in Mexico, all they have to do is buy an imported cell phone from some other country that's also a prepaid by cash cell phone, and bingo, you've got another cell phone that's not registered from the with the government, that won't ever be registered with the government. And since they're making scads of money on kidnappings or drug business, they'll be easily be able to pay for the long distance that will be incurred with those cell phones. And another hit that is going to be completely useless, that just cuts off and makes it difficult for normal people to use the internet and data communications down in Mexico. Free speech news from Mexico. The battle cartels, Mexico weighs Twitter crackdown. Sent up by SEMA 4. Mexican drug cartels appear to have adopted a new technique to avoid military raids and police checkpoints using Facebook and Twitter. And so now the Mexican government is trying to crack down on the use of Facebook and Twitter. Facebook has been on the radar of government officials who believe that it's being used to facilitate the abduction and relatives of powerful businessmen and politicians with kidnappers, allegedly using the social networking site to discover the identities of high-profile persons' families' members. Meanwhile, authorities have already peeved that the ordinary citizens be using Twitter to alert one another to the locations of breathalyzer checkpoints via at @ANTIAA_DF, and enough furious that drug dealers are using Twitter accounts to circumvent dragnets and communicate with one another. Twitter is a serious problem, not only to Mexican law enforcement agencies, but to any law or intelligence agencies all over the world, because criminals, drug cartels, and terrorist cells are getting more sophisticated in their methods of communication. And so, another try to shut down data communications that is going to be completely ineffective. You shut down or try and restrict Twitter or Facebook or any of these or sites that are social networking sites or open posting sites. They're just going to move to the next one and the next one and the next one. It is pointless to invest time or anything into these. It is actually better to keep them going because you do know about them and you know where they are and you'll be able to keep on top of it and kind of be able to outwit them by knowing their lines of communications. If you go after these lines of communications, you're going to drive them underground or move them somewhere else that you won't know. And then you're going to have to track them, or they're going to be encrypted and you'll never find out about them. Keep them open so you can keep track of them. Now in Pirate Party news, we've got some good news here. PPCA statement regarding party registration statuses from Pirate Party of Canada. We're pleased to announce that as of April 12th, the Pirate Party of Canada is officially eligible for party status. After 10 months of dedicated and hard work, we have reached eligible status, which only leaves a 60-day purgatory period. After that, we'll field candidates in subsequent federal elections and begin the real work of a political party. This day wouldn't have arrived without you, the people of Canada. When we set out for the call for forms, you answered. Boy, did you answer. With a bare minimum of 250 forms being reached in a short amount of time, we were shocked to see that the confirmation forms all within the space of a month. It goes to show you that normal Canadians who really run the country care about what goes on behind the scenes, in the dark, closed boardrooms, and at the negotiating tables of ACTA, the RIAA, and the CRTC. You've shown that we aren't going to take the indignity of losing technological and cultural rights so that the record labels and big companies can further gouge us. The PPCA couldn't have reached this milestone without the help and support of a great team of our dedicated volunteers. Everyone who has contributed to the PPCA core team deserves the highest accolades for everything they have done. I would personally like to thank a few people whose contributions have made the greatest difference to our efforts. Firstly, Rob Britton deserves our thanks as he was just the one... He was the one who took a handful of internet nerds in the spring of last year, made a forum in June, and started the PPCA as we know it today, as well as serving our first interim director. Secondly, Stephanie Bakos deserves a million thanks. It was he who has been the physical and technological driving force of our movement, hosting the website and server, managing the money, making the payments, and many other everyday tasks most of us would never dream of taking on. He has single-handedly maintained the well-oiled machine of the movement. A most specific thank you has gone to Jake Danes, PPCA's leader. Jake has taken on a titanic workload and managed to bring a leadership and organization to our group. He has been there to take part in all of our decisions, to deal with any problems, and to make sure that we are all on task and focused on what we're doing. Without these people, this day would never have arrived. We all know that what is needed to keep Canada sustainable in this technological world. We need a world with net neutrality, a world where artists and inventors are free to create without the chains of mismanagement and executive privilege. We need to foster technological development in all fields of everyday life in an open manner. We need to bring focus to the privacy of the individual while shedding light on the work that the government does so we can avoid hidden laws and treaties that attack Canadians. Now is the time for PPCA to begin our serious work in earnest. Our goals will now shift from mundane procedural tasks to real-world issues. If we don't work to earn the trust of the hundreds of Canadians who have lent their support to our cause, the future of Canada may remain in the hands of the people whom we can't hold accountable for their actions. Your further support, such as contributions of time and money, is necessary to continue the fight for responsible information management, representation, and citizen action. We couldn't have done it without you. Congratulations to the Pirate Party of Canada, which is in fact the first Pirate Party outside of Europe to be registered as a political party. So congratulations. And there's an online Pirate Party of Canada general meeting on April 19th, 2010 at 5 p.m. Pacific Time, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. And I've put the link in the forums. Or just head over to the Pirate Party of Canada website if you're in Canada. And Hungary, LMP party passes the voting threshold. So this is in Hungary. This is sent in by Platon from the Romanian Pirate Party. He says, you might be interested to know that after the first round of the two of the Hungarian parliamentary elections, the LMP party gained 7.5% of the votes, thus passing the threshold. This is important because LMP is a representative of pirate ideas in Hungary. There is no political pirate party in Hungary, but there is a non-political organization called Kalotspárt, which means pirate party, that is affiliated with the LMP party. So you can read all about that in the translated link that I've provided in the Pirate Party forums. And he says, P.S., keep up this awesome show. Well, I will. Thank you. And also he sent in, Bulgaria Pirate Party has been founded. After years of sporadic online discussions, the formal founding forum of Bulgarian's Pirate Party was held in Sofia on April 11, 2009. Delegates from 20 Bulgarian towns adopted the Articles of Constitution and the party's political program, the party said in a statement on its website. So congratulations to the Pirate Party of Bulgaria, who's just starting out. And also Pirate Party's international conference in Brussels from April 16th to 18th. So this is this weekend. On April 16th to 18th, 2010, April, 70 representatives of pirate parties from 22 countries will meet in Brussels to form the umbrella organization, Pirate Parties International, prepare a common declaration of principles for pirate parties, and elect the first official board of the PPI. On Sunday, 18th of at 1400 hours local time, a press conference will be held to inform the public about the outcome of the discussions and give the newly elected board the opportunity to present the organization. And they're going to be doing a live stream of the conference. You can tune in this weekend at pirate-streaming.net. And you can contact them at coreteam@pp-international.net. And I've got some closing words from, I think it's called a TV show called Hungry Beast, talking about Google. This is from an Australian TV show. It says, meet Google, the noun that becomes a verb, the world's favorite search engine, and the company whose motto is do, don't be evil. So remember, if any of these stories have interested you, or you'd like to just drop me a comment, or if you'd like to just ask a question, please check out the website piratepartyradio.com, and you can also check out your local pirate party, because if these interest you, Pirate Party will interest you as well. And find out what you can do to help preserve your rights and freedoms. And if you have any news stories you'd like to hear on the show, or questions or comments, just head over to piratepartyradio.com and submit them through the easy-to-fill-out form on the website. It goes straight to me. Thank you for listening, and until next time, this has been James O'Brien for Pirate Party Radio.
Meet Google, the noun that became a verb, the world's favorite search engine, the company whose motto is, don't be evil. Google processes 1 billion web searches every day using 450,000 servers. But it's more than just a search engine. Intel CEO Andy Grove calls Google, which has a market value of $200 billion, a company on steroids with a finger in every industry. Google has acquired 30 other companies in the last 9 years and patented 187 products. Last year, it launched a venture capital arm to invest in software, clean tech, biotech, healthcare, and no doubt other areas we haven't thought of yet. Here's a few of the things Google wants to own: your phone, your email, your computer, and your entire digital life. Whatever you want to do online, Google wants to be your one-stop shop. It also wants to own the cables that deliver the internet itself and the electricity to power them. Google also wants to provide your entertainment and your news. It wants to build the largest library ever. This project is currently the subject of a class action lawsuit brought by publishers and authors. And it wants to know where everything is, from your front lawn all the way to Mars. Google wants to track you, storing records of everything you look at online for 18 months. It also wants access to your health records and your DNA, with two of its early investments in genetic testing companies. Google wants to follow your friendships. Social media platform Google Buzz was engulfed in complaints last month over alleged privacy breaches. It is now the subject of another class action lawsuit, and it's not the first time that privacy has been an issue. Google Maps and Google Earth have been criticized for including photos of naked kids, people vomiting, and leaving sex shops. 2 months ago, Google CEO Eric Schmidt said of privacy concerns, "If you have something you don't want anyone to know, maybe you shouldn't be doing it in the first place." Why does Google want to know so much about you? As Schmidt says, "We are in the advertising business. 97% of its revenue comes from ads. Google wants to know who you are, where you are, and what you like, so it can target ads at you." Google, building an empire on your street, on your phone, in your DNA, trying very hard not to be evil.